Hello, dreamers, and welcome to this week's episode of California Dreaming. Before we get started, I have a few notes about the show. This is an independent one-woman podcast, which means I depend on you, the listeners, to help keep the show in production, and there are a number of ways that you can help. You can leave a nice rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or whichever platforms you listen to your shows on. You can follow me on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, comment, share, like, all the good stuff. You can recommend the show in true crime discussion groups and forums. And if you would like to go a little above and beyond, you can subscribe to California Dreaming's Patreon. We are still going strong, starting at just $1 a month. That price is never going to increase. You will gain access to dozens of exclusive full-length episodes that you won't hear anywhere else. And if a subscription just isn't your thing and you would still like to make a contribution, you can do so through PayPal using my email, californiapod@gmail.com. The links to everything that I just mentioned can be found in the show notes. And that's all I've got for now. Let's get on with today's episode. This is the second part of a two-part series entitled Getting Crafty with a Wood Chipper. If you haven't listened to part one yet, pause this, go and listen to the first part, and then come back to this one. In part one, we talked about the relationship between airline pilot Richard Crafts and his wife, Helly, who was a flight attendant. They lived with their three children and a nanny in Newtown, Connecticut. On the surface, it appeared that the Crafts had a picture-perfect family life. But when a couple of layers are peeled away, like with a lot of families, we see that not everything is as nice or as good as it seems. We came to find that Richard Crafts was a lying, cheating, narcissistic, manipulative garbage of a husband and a human being who Helly was fixing to divorce. Prior to the last trip that Helly took with Pan Am to Frankfurt, Germany, she had plans to sit down with Richard and discuss the divorce because he had been ducking and diving the process server and would not accept the divorce papers. However, sometime between the time Helly was dropped off at home the last night that she worked, which was November 18th, 1986, and later on in the early morning hours when the electricity in the house was knocked out by a huge ice storm that hit Newtown and the surrounding communities throughout the night. Sometime during those two events, Helly vanished into thin air. And it never looks good when the friends of the missing person are all but convinced that the person responsible for Helly being missing was her own husband. She had been telling her friends for weeks that she felt all this anger and resentment coming from her husband. And she had made an ominous declaration. If something were to happen to her, make sure it gets investigated thoroughly, because she believed Richard was capable of killing her and staging it to look like an accident. Little did Helly know that Richard actually had something much more gruesome in mind. Also in part one, we talked about how the police early on actually quickly eliminated Richard Crafts as a suspect in Helly's disappearance. They said in the shows that I watched about this case that he passed the polygraph examination with flying colors, and that polygraph was apparently conducted by two examiners, and they both detected no deception in speaking to Richard. The thing that got to me was the fact that during the polygraph, Richard admitted that he lied about Helly's whereabouts in the beginning to investigators, friends, and family because he said he didn't want to reveal the truth, which was apparently embarrassing, that he and Helly were talking divorce because of this infidelity. And because he was hooked up to the polygraph when he made that admission and it was showing that there was no deception, they just gave Richard the benefit of the doubt for being truthful that time. Never mind the fact that he had been lying through his teeth to everyone for weeks by then. I will never understand how they so easily brushed Richard Crafts aside off the suspect list because he eventually told the truth, and it's only because Hallie's friends wouldn't accept his stupid explanations and excuses about where she was at. They're the ones that dug around and found out the truth. They were doing the work that the police wouldn't or were too afraid to do. They seemed intimidated by Richard from start to finish, but thankfully, Hallie had people who loved and cared about her. And most importantly, they didn't like Richard, like at all. And that was important because authorities were really on pace to blow this entire case. Because of the persistence of Hallie's friends, her divorce attorney, and the private investigator that she hired before she vanished, her husband and only suspect, Richard, did make his way back onto the suspect list, and police finally started digging for evidence to try and figure out what the heck happened to Hallie. And what they found is Hallie's blood was all over the master bedroom. The nanny saw bloodstains on the carpeting, which Richard ripped out and threw away in a local landfill. And when the walls started closing in on him, Richard decided to go ahead and take off for Florida for the winter break. And while he was gone, that's when a search warrant for his house was served. And that's when they found that the house had been completely ransacked. But they ended up finding more bloodstains on a king-size mattress. And while DNA testing was not available at the time, the blood that was found was tested and was shown to have come from a female with type O blood. And of course, Hallie was a female and she did indeed have type O blood. In messing up the house the way that he did, Richard was clearly trying to cause more confusion and cover up. But he ended up creating a lot more evidence than he destroyed, really. In searching through Richard's finances, investigators found that on the night Hallie disappeared, on the night of Storm Carl, Richard had rented a commercial wood chipper. And twice during the night, once in the middle of the night and once right before dawn, a snowplow driver saw Richard Craft standing on a steel bridge that crossed a river, operating a wood chipper with it pointed out over the river and over the riverbed. When Hallie's disappearance became big news in the media, tips did start coming in, and the snow plow driver was one of them. With his information about seeing Richard on a bridge with a wood chipper, it finally offered investigators a place to actually start looking for Hallie, which they'd been trying to do for more than a month by then. They made their way over to the riverbed as quickly as they could, and for days, everybody sifted through the mud and the dirt in an effort to try and recover anything at all that came from Hallie. And they did. In all, they had just under 3 ounces of bone, hair, a toenail, a fingertip, and a tooth. They also found a shredded up letter to Hallie from her mother and bits of fabric that the nanny said matched up with Hallie's favorite nightgown to wear around the house. And with that, authorities had enough to charge Richard Crafts with first-degree murder. Even when they went to arrest him, he stayed inside his house like a big-ass, whiny, tantrumy man-baby and didn't want to come out because he knew that he got caught. Eventually, he surrendered without incident, and he was locked up to await his trial. That's where we left off in part one. We will pick it up from there. So let's get on to the second part of this story. Part two of Getting Crafty with the Wood Chipper. The prosecution thought that the biggest problem that they were going to have was winning a conviction without a body. They were able to put together enough pieces of evidence, much of it circumstantial, in order to charge Richard with Hallie's murder. Winning the case was going to be another story, however. Today, a case like this would be a no-brainer with the same evidence that they had then, but not so much when it comes to the general public, the people that the jury would be chosen from. Are they going to get it? I mean, if the investigators themselves were so easily thrown off of Richard's trail, it's going to come down to convincing them. And you know, what was going to happen in Richard's case was kind of the same thing that happened in O.J. Simpson's case. At least that's kind of what I'm seeing, what was going on here. I think the jury got fatigued by all the science-y testimony. At the time, according to Dr. Henry Lee, this was one of the most extensive investigations that he had ever had to date. And that's because of all the physical evidence that they recovered from the Crafts house and from the riverbed. And I mean, if you listen to Dr. Henry Lee speak, talk about monotone and boring. He had so much stuff that he needed to analyze for this case, and he went over every single bit of it. He had to explain everything to the jury, piece by piece. The blood typing, the hair evidence, the tool mark evidence left on the bone chips, the analysis of the fabric. They analyzed the handwriting on the shredded up letter that they found. Dr. Lee was on the stand at trial for 6 days. I could not listen to that man speak for hours on end, much less 6 days in a row about the most boring stuff ever. The state medical examiner, in order to make the comparison to the pieces of bones that were found that had been put through the wood chipper, to show how similar shards of bone could be replicated, he used a pig carcass and ran that through the wood chipper, and they were able to recreate near identical bone chips that they had found when they were searching for Hallie's remains. Just in case that there was any doubt about what Richard Crafts did to his wife's body, they just wanted to make sure that the jury understood that that guy actually did that. He put her through that wood chipper piece by piece. The trial itself lasted for more than 4 months. The jury not only had to sit through 6 days of Henry Lee, they had to sit through more than 100 other witnesses. So this was a pretty lengthy process for them. At trial, the state put forth a theory that Richard intentionally killed his wife because their marriage was falling apart due to his infidelity. Hallie had retained a divorce attorney and hired a private investigator in order to get the evidence that she needed to prove that Richard was seeing somebody else. According to Hallie's friends and co-workers, in recent weeks prior to her disappearance, Hallie had expressed her concerns over Richard's attitude and behavior towards her. She described him as having been very mean and angry, and made it clear that he would not be going through with the divorce. Hallie told her friends that if something happened to her, just whatever it is, whatever happens to her, it just has to be investigated properly. At some point, Richard began devising a plan to just get rid of Hallie altogether. And what he was going to do was make up a story that she walked out on him and their 3 children, just like that. No questions asked, no goodbyes, no nothing. The night that the storm knocked out the power, sometime after Hallie had arrived home from her final flight, but before Richard woke up the kids and the babysitter, I believe it was during that time that Richard murdered Hallie inside their master bedroom. I believe that he already had everything that he needed rented or purchased, and everything was ready to go. And that included a wood chipper, the chainsaw, and a freezer. And he also, come to find out, purchased a new truck in order to haul the wood chipper, but he ran into a little bit of complication, which I will tell you about in a minute. So clearly, all of this was premeditated, which for me really adds another like layer of evilness to this guy. Because, you know, in other crimes where there has been this elaborate effort to cover up a murder where dismemberment is involved, and to me it always kind of seems like an afterthought, you know? I never really thought that someone has this idea to cut a body up into pieces as a part of their murder plan, but once they find themselves stuck with this dead body, they're just kind of like, okay, what the hell else can I do to get rid of this body now? And the gruesome task begins when they decide, out of sheer desperation, to cover up the crime by cutting them up. And you know, honestly, as I'm sitting here thinking about this, I've actually had a recurring dream that I've done something like that. I don't know if I killed the person, but I have this recurring dream that I'm having to deal with a dead body. And I don't know who the dead body is. All I know is that it's a man, and in my dream, for some reason, I have to get rid of it somehow. And I seem to choose dismemberment. But anyway, that's probably information that you all did not need to have, but it's just this dream. I just got reminded of it just now. So anyway, the state of Connecticut said that Richard Krapps came up with this whole plan to get rid of his wife by completely obliterating her body. The state presented a great deal of evidence, though it was primarily circumstantial. It included evidence of the couple's marital troubles, as well as evidence of what Richard was up to in late 1986 and early 1987, where it was established that he had, with intent, murdered his wife. Well, all the while, Richard insisted to the contrary that he did not kill his wife. He at first was telling everybody that Helly was in Denmark visiting her sick mother, but that turned out to be a lie. And when this jerk admitted to lying about his wife visiting her sick mother while hooked up to a polygraph, since he admitted to lying and was apparently being truthful while admitting to being a liar, he was basically dismissed as a suspect by the detectives on the case. If it wasn't for the persistence of the private investigator that Helly had hired, Richard may have never been charged with her murder. After he admitted that he lied about her being in Denmark, he continued to lie by saying that he had no idea where she was at all, which he apparently also passed with flying colors when he said that on the polygraph, lying through his teeth. So I don't really know what to make of this whole polygraph mess. I don't know if Richard Krapps was that good or if these polygraphers are just that bad or it was just a fluke, probably. The guy was really weird. There is nothing normal about this Richard Krapps guy at all. The state was able to establish that Helly did have intentions of filing for divorce, as it would be Richard's claim that he was unaware of anything of the sort. She also told several friends that she intended to divorce Richard, and that was his motive for murdering Helly, according to the state. The state was also able to establish through testimony of friends and family that marital troubles would have never caused Helly to leave her home or her family on her own. Helly was described as very devoted to her children and to her job, and she simply would not walk away from her life voluntarily. Helly had every intention of seeking full custody of her children. She had been talking about it with her friends, and she would not have left without telling anyone where she was going or without any explanation like that. The prosecutor had witnesses who said Helly told them that if anything unusual were to happen to her, they should not believe that such an event would be of her own making. So I think that's pretty clear that she saw something was coming for her. The last time Helly was seen or heard from was on November 18, 1986, when she was dropped off at home by a co-worker. Early in the morning on November 19th, Richard ushered his three children and the babysitter out of his house and over to his sister's, as he told the babysitter because of the power outage and the lack of heat in the house, he wanted to take them over there instead, despite the fact that Richard did have several alternative sources of heating, including kerosene heaters, a fireplace, and a generator. The nanny and the kids did not see Helly when Richard woke them up, but he told them that she left earlier on another flight for work. In his rush to leave the house, Richard made no attempt to get his children dressed for the severe icy weather, and he drove through some very dangerous and difficult conditions in order to leave the kids with his sister. Helly was not with them when they were dropped off, and Richard did not mention Helly to his sister, nor did she ask about where she was. Given all of the evidence that was presented at trial, the jury could then reasonably infer that the chances were when Richard dropped the kids and the nanny off at his sister's house that Helly was already dead, that he killed her during the night, and this was him preparing to carry out the cover-up. Through the examination of Richard's financial records and purchases, as part of his plan prior to the events of November 18th and 19th, he had arranged for the rental of a wood chipper, he had purchased a new truck with which to haul the wood chipper, and he purchased the large freezer. Richard picked up the freezer on November 17th, the day before Helly got back from Germany. He wanted to pick up the wood chipper on November 18th, but he actually wasn't able to do so until 2 days later on November 20th. He had to obtain a rental truck instead of using the new truck that he had purchased because the delivery of the new truck had been delayed. Richard then returned the rented wood chipper and the rented truck on November 21st. So this information is a little bit different than what we saw on Forensic Files. It said in that show that Richard was witnessed out there the night of the storm with the wood chipper running and having it pointed out over the side of a bridge. But this information that I'm telling you now about the having to get the rental truck came from the court documents. But either way, it's a small detail. He still did that with the wood chipper, and that was some elaborate planning on his part, right? This guy really did not want to get divorced. Like, really bad he did not want to get divorced. And he did not want his wife walking out on him either. He's one of those types of guys that wasn't going to have it. So Richard and Helly had an older freezer that, as far as anyone knew, was in working order. It was in their house. That is until just about the middle of November. All of a sudden, that old freezer, nobody knew what happened to it. It was never located during the police investigation that ensued following Helly's disappearance. When Richard was asked about the old freezer and the purchase of a new one, he just said that he replaced the old one because it gave out and that he disposed of it himself at a local dump site. It was reasonable for the jury to infer that the older freezer was used to store Helly's body until Richard was able to gain access to the wood chipper and the rental truck. And then once he was done feeding Helly's frozen body parts through the wood chipper, he disposed of the freezer in an unknown location in order for any of the forensic evidence that it could contain could not be gathered and linked back to him. Again, that freezer was never found. So it was on the evening of November 20th, going into the early morning hours of November 21st, when witnesses observed a wood chipper being pulled around by a rental truck at various locations in the general area of Richard and Helly's home. The wood chipper was also seen being pulled by the rental truck near the offices of Richard's part-time employer, the town of Southbury. At 6:30 p.m., the wood chipper, being operated by a single individual, was observed near a steel bridge in Newtown. Between 3 a.m. and 4 a.m., the wood chipper was observed at various locations in the vicinity of the same steel bridge, again being operated by a lone individual. At approximately 4 a.m., Richard, along with the rental truck and wood chipper, was parked in a Southbury school parking lot. There, a co-worker talked to the defendant, who, in response to the co-worker's inquiry regarding the wood chipper, replied that he was cleaning up limbs that were downed in the November 18th storm. Other evidence, however, indicated that no limbs had been downed during that storm, and there were no other existing needs for a wood chipper that anyone could see. The area where Richard was seen using the wood chipper was searched by Connecticut State Police officers. They searched near the steel bridge and eventually recovered all of those items that I've previously mentioned: the bone chips, the fingernail, a toe, a tooth with some crown work, some tissue, hair, pieces of shredded up mail, fabric that was similar in color to a clothing item that Helly was known to wear around the house. All of the items that could be forensically linked to Helly were, including the hair, the tooth, and the fingernail. They also recovered that chainsaw that Richard had ditched into the river as well. Because of the grease that was on the chainsaw, it still had biological material, blood, tissue, hair, and cotton fibers stuck to it, even though it had been submerged in water for several weeks. As the investigation into Helly's disappearance carried on, Richard offered a variety of people different stories about what happened to his wife. And all of the stories he provided would eventually be proven to be lies. The one about visiting her sick mom. There was another story that Richard told that she was visiting friends overseas. Richard told police in one of his interviews that he last saw Helly on November 19th, which was probably true. She just was likely not alive and on her way to being frozen. Richard also told police that Helly was in the Canary Islands visiting a friend over there. In addition to providing all of these lies and contradictory statements regarding his wife's whereabouts, Richard had also made some incriminating remarks to acquaintances regarding the police investigation into Helly's disappearance, which could be indicative of a consciousness of guilt. For example, when Richard's brother-in-law told him that the state police were going to send divers into the water to search for Helly, Richard said, "Let him dive. There's no body. It's gone." Richard's murder trial began in May of 1998. And it had been moved to New London, about an hour and a half away from Newtown. There were a total of 54 days of testimony before the jury was given the case to deliberate. Like I had mentioned earlier, they had a lot of information to digest from the evidence that had been collected. Again, 6 days alone of just Dr. Henry Lee. Lots of reconstruction of pieces of evidence, dozens and dozens of witnesses, thousands of pieces of evidence entered in as exhibits. It did begin to drag on and on by the time it got to the jury, and then they would sit there and take 17 days of deliberations for them to get to the conclusion that they had one single juror that was holding out. That 17 days became the longest jury deliberations in Connecticut state history. But that guy, the juror, he had his mind made up. It just seemed like Richard, it was as if Richard had someone in his corner every step of the way when it came to getting him to the point where he was going to be made to answer for what he was being accused of. But yet he somehow lucks out again and managed to get the most ignorant person in the state of Connecticut, who could not be convinced that Helly was truly dead, because he was refusing to convict without the body. And after 17 days of arguing with all the other jurors, this guy flat out refused to participate in the deliberations any longer. And with that, a mistrial was declared. A second trial was held the following year, this time in the city of Norwalk, Connecticut. The prosecution still had this overwhelming amount of evidence to present, but this time around, the challenge that they weren't really able to overcome in the first trial was the fact that they had such a largely circumstantial case. In order to tell the story, you have to have an idea of what happened, and they really didn't know exactly what happened to Helly. They didn't know how she died. They didn't know exactly where or how or when she was murdered. They didn't know what she was murdered with, though it's strongly believed that she was murdered with some kind of blunt force injury based on the blood spatter evidence that was eventually found when investigators were able to search the Crafts' home. They also didn't really have a murder weapon, though they believe it was some sort of blunt object that Richard ended up burning in the fireplace with other pieces of evidence that he worked so hard at trying to destroy. They also had no witnesses to the actual murder, but the witness who placed Richard on the bridge with the wood chipper, that was really one of the biggest linchpins of the case. And it's amazing. Like I've said it a couple times up to this point, this guy, Richard Crafts, is such an arrogant son of a bitch, driving around town with a wood chipper and a missing wife, as if nobody would think that that's suspicious at all. So what the prosecution decided to do the second time around is they gave a story as to what they believed happened to Helly. That she got back the night of the storm from her trip. At some point that night or into the next morning, she and Richard got into a fight or they argued. But honestly, Richard already had all the stuff to get rid of Helly completely. He had already rented and bought everything. He may have wanted to wait until he got his new truck delivered before he got started. But what Richard may have been looking for is for Helly to be willing to back off the divorce talk and to sort of reach a compromise with him. But they started having this discussion when they got back from Germany, or when she got back from Germany, and she had already made up her mind and she was not going to be swayed. So because Richard wasn't getting the answers out of Helly that he wanted to hear, he went ahead and bludgeoned her to death and began this task of making Helly cease to exist anymore. The prosecution believed that he then rolled Helly up into the carpeting that he cut up and ripped out of the master bedroom, but not before the babysitter got a look at the dark stains that investigators believed to be blood. From there, Richard got rid of his kids and the babysitter by taking them to his sister's house. When he came back, he then moved Helly's body into the old freezer that they had at their house, and he would end up storing her body in there for about a day. Once Helly's body was frozen, then it made the task of cutting her up with a chainsaw a much more easier process than if she was not frozen. According to Dr. Henry Lee, once Helly was frozen, it was quite simple for Richard to just chainsaw her up into small sections that would be easy to transport. The day that Richard was running around getting rid of Helly's body, he was supposed to have picked up his kids from his sister's house around 2 p.m. that afternoon, but he actually did not show up at that time, not even close. It was way later into the night before he finally got his kids. And we know what he was doing. The second jury fortunately got it right and found Richard guilty on November 20th, 1989, almost 3 years to the day that Helly vanished. He was sentenced to 50 years in prison. But in January of 2020, Richard was released from prison and sent to live at a halfway house for veterans. And I'm not quite sure where he's at today. He might still be living in some sort of facility for veterans. He's like 86 years old now, but somewhere out there still, he's alive and kicking. He is officially out of the State Department of Corrections with good time and a good record in prison. Richard actually reached his maximum sentence date, which was set for August 1st of 2020. So in part one, I mentioned an article that I had read. It was actually a blog post written by a Cub reporter for the Newtown Bee back in the day in 1986, when the story that we talked about in these two parts took place. I found the blog looking up some information on Storm Carl, that ice storm that came through the night that Helly Craps vanished. That cub reporter was Lisa Peterson, and she had just gotten out of college and was hired as a journalist with the Newtown Bee on October 28, 1985, a little more than a year before Helly disappeared. Lisa was a staff reporter for the police beat, so her early articles consisted of sheep randomly roaming around the town loose, flags being stolen off of flagpoles, and the occasional dead person. Lisa wrote in her blog, "My first story was about a $1 million property transfer from a doctor's estate to Danbury Hospital for a new wing and a tower. It was to be named in Dr. Strook's memory. As a part of the story, I toured his 300-acre Buckeye Farm on the corner of Cemetery and Flat Swamp Roads located in Newtown's Poverty Hollow District. This part of town was dotted with dairy farms, rolling pastures, and landscapes that screamed bucolic. Little did I know that a year earlier, just down the road, was a barn belonging to a young mother who went missing. In fact, her case kicked off a string of missing Newtown wives and suspect husbands. Elizabeth Heath, Helly Craps, and Regina Brown, all of them in the 1980s. These murder cases would embroil and devour the Newtown Police Department, for which I had just been hired to cover as my beat. About a year after I started my B tenure, on November 19, 1986, Storm Carl battered the small New England town. This late autumn snowstorm encased everything, including power lines, in icy inches. A photographer from our rival daily newspaper, the News Times in Danbury, had traveled to the top of Castle Hill. He captured one of the most iconic images on one of the most unforgettable days. White buildings, a gray steeple, snow-covered evergreens, and the flagpole took on a silent blue hue. The only color in the photo was the American flag, the one frequently stolen, blowing in a stiff breeze. There was no power. The town was cold. The bee offices were closed that morning. I stayed home. To stay warm, I nestled in bed with my dogs since my electric heat would not work. Looking out my window, all I saw was my breath and ice." That was the night that Helly vanished. Then, about 4 months later, another flight attendant, this time with American Airlines, went missing either on March 26th or 27th of 1987. And her name was Regina Brown. At the time, she was 35 years old. She was married to Willis Brown, who was a senior pilot with American Airlines, just like Helly's husband had been a pilot as well. This couple also had 3 children, and her friends, like Helly's friends, described Regina as devoted to her family and to her work with American Airlines. And also like Helly, Regina was in the process of filing for divorce from her husband. For years, Regina had suffered a tremendous amount of physical and emotional abuse at the hands of her husband. He regularly accused Regina of infidelity and often made the accusation that their children weren't biologically his, which to me means I can almost guarantee that he was the one who was cheating. She may or may not have been, but she had all of her children's paternity tested, and you know what? What you talk about, Willis is the father of all of them. But because of his abusive behavior towards Regina, she was able to get a protection order taken out against him, and with that, he was effectively removed from his own house, which probably really angered him. The last time Regina was seen was at LaGuardia Airport in Queens on or about March 26th or 27th, 1987. At that point, Regina had already sent 2 of her 3 children to Texas to stay with her mother down there, and she was getting ready to send her 3rd and final child along with their babysitter to join the other 2 with her mother. After dropping them off at LaGuardia, Regina began the drive back to her home in Newtown. In the last phone conversation that Regina had with her best friend, she told her that if she did not make contact with her parents in 4 days' time, to be very alarmed and that something has probably happened to her. And that if her friend doesn't hear from her in 2 days, that meant Willis followed through on a threat that he was going to, quote, do something to her. After speaking to her best friend and apparently making her way towards her home in Newtown, somewhere along the way, Regina vanished, and she has not been seen or heard from since. Everything that Regina had, all of her worldly possessions that she would have taken with her if she had decided to walk away from her life voluntarily, everything was left behind. Most importantly, her 3 children. On March 27th, Regina's dog had been barking so much and for so long, nonstop, that it actually caused a neighbor to contact authorities to file a complaint. After that day, nobody ever heard from Regina. All communication from her had stopped. All communication with her mom and her children, they never heard from her. She started to miss work. She began to miss appointments and social events. American Airlines finally contacted Regina's mom in order to notify them that she had not been showing up for work. Her mom, in turn, contacted her best friend, the one that Regina had spoken to the last night that she was known to be alive, and asked her if she could go and check on her at her house. 5 or 6 days later, on April 2nd, 1987, the best friend went over to Regina's house in Newtown to see if she could figure out what was going on. When she got there, she made her way into the garage and was surprised to find Regina's dog locked in the garage by itself with a bowl of water and an unopened bag of dog food. This kind of sounds like something that would have been left behind by animal control. If they thought a dog was left without food and water, they'll go and do that sometimes. They'll leave like food behind for the dog. If somebody calls to complain or report an abandoned animal. But the friend knew what kind of food Regina fed to her dog, and this was not the brand that she used. The garage was also covered in dog feces, so clearly Regina's dog had been left there for quite some time. At that point, Regina's best friend did report her missing, but her husband, Willis, he reported her missing as well. Regina's car, a bronze Honda Accord, was found parked and abandoned in front of an apartment building in Manhattan 4 days after she was reported missing on April 6th. The keys to her vehicle were right there, inserted into the ignition, and there were a number of parking tickets that were left on the windshield. There did not appear to be any sort of struggle in or around the car, nor was there any indication of where Regina may have gone or what could have happened to her. Of course, it was Regina's own husband, Willis, who had previously suggested to investigators early on when they spoke to him that they might want to try looking at some areas of Manhattan where there might be a lot of drug activity, that they might find her car down in that area. However, it isn't clear if that's the place where Regina's car was found and if that was known to be a busy drug activity area. But just the fact that her car was found in Manhattan after Willis suggested it makes him super suspicious to me. So Willis did get his children back from his wife's mother down in Texas, and he brought them all back to Connecticut. However, in what I thought was kind of a surprising move, 3 weeks later, a judge ordered them to be sent back to their maternal grandparents. After Regina vanished, Willis did continue the process of filing for divorce when his case was seen later on that year in September before the divorce court judge. Willis told the judge that Regina was a serial cheater and was addicted to drugs, but the judge, who oversaw their case, found that Willis had been physically and emotionally abusive to Regina throughout their relationship. There was plenty of documentation and evidence of that, and he ended up giving his children to Regina's parents, full custody, all 3 of them. Willis lost his 3 kids in the wake of his wife's disappearance. And the judge also found that there was no basis for the claims about Regina using drugs or having affairs. There was just no evidence that any of that was true. Willis has long been considered a person of interest in Regina's disappearance, but there has never been enough evidence to ever bring about any charges. In an interesting little side note, Willis did own a small private plane the year that Regina vanished. After she vanished, the plane vanished as well for the next 11 years, and it did not resurface until 2008, when all of a sudden, Willis's plane reappeared. Nobody was ever able to determine whether or not Willis flew his small private plane on the night of March 27th or any time during that day, because the airport that he parked his plane at did not keep very good records. Police also did not conduct a search of Regina's home in Newtown until almost 2 months after she disappeared. So if there was anything incriminating inside the house in the way of evidence, Willis had plenty of time to clean it up and get rid of it all. There had been several attempts through the years to search for Regina's remains, but all of it has been to no avail. She was declared legally dead in 1995. Now, I did read that at the time Storm Carl came through Newtown, Regina was at her home that night. Willis was already out of the house and the process of divorce had already been started. She, in fact, had that protective order against him at the time. But the storm, it knocked out the power in Regina's house just like it had at Richard and Helly's house as well. And she had her three kids to think about. There was a coal stove in the basement, but Regina needed some help getting it started. So she ended up having to call her estranged husband to get to the house so he could help get it warmed up for the kids. Even though she had that order of protection in effect at the time, it had been about a month, she had him over anyway. So the storm actually caused Regina to have to let her abusive husband back into her home. And who knew, on that very same night, Richard Crafts was fixing to do away with his wife in a manner that wasn't apparently as effective as whatever it was Willis did to Regina. So there is a third missing wife from Newtown from the 1980s, and it happened a couple of years earlier. Her name was Elizabeth Heath, and back in April of 1984, just days after her husband John Heath filed for divorce, Elizabeth suddenly went missing. At the time, she was 30 years old. John was the one who reported her missing, and he was telling people that she left and took about $600 with her. But, like Richard Crafts, he was also telling people inconsistent stories. He would say to other family members and friends different versions of what happened, including telling others that she left and she had no money with her. Elizabeth's body was actually found 26 years later by a father and son while they were renovating a barn on the property. They were working on breaking apart an old damaged floor in the barn when they discovered an old covered up well. Inside the well, they found pillows, a blanket, a pillowcase, and a plastic bag that had a human leg bone in it. Elizabeth had apparently been wrapped up in some bed linens, and she was placed headfirst into the well inside this barn. Her skull also had a plastic bag over it. When police asked John about it, he said that he was the one that renovated the barn back in 1990, and he used a jackhammer to open up the hole in the floor for the well, and he was the one that placed a cast iron pipe under the concrete. At the time, a relative of his reported that when he asked him about what was under the concrete, John had told him that it was an old septic tank and to just leave it alone. When Elizabeth's remains were pulled out of the well and examined by the medical examiner, her death was ruled a homicide, as she was found to have suffered 4 blunt force blows to the skull. Her left arm was also broken, and that is consistent with her having attempted to fend off some of the blows that were coming at her, and her jawbone had been completely amputated from the rest of her face. So yeah, that guy, he beat the shit out of his wife, beat her to death. John Heath ended up losing that home with the barn where he had hidden his wife's body all those years earlier in 2005 to foreclosure. 2 years after Elizabeth's remains were found in May of 2012, John Heath was finally arrested and charged with her murder some 28 years after the fact. John was subsequently convicted and sentenced to 50 years in prison, but he ended up passing away after only serving 3 years. However, when you look at pictures of this guy and you know that he lost his house in 2005, you just know, be satisfied in knowing that this guy had a really, really shitty life. And that, my dreamers, is the one with the wood chipper. I have really been enjoying taking a look back at some of these old forensic file cases so much, but I do have a couple more stories out of the state of Connecticut for this series that I started a couple weeks ago that I intend to wrap up very shortly. I think I'll even throw one of them up on Patreon for the month as well, so don't forget to check out California Dreaming on all the social media places, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. I do also have Snapchat and TikTok if that's your thing. I'm not a lot of fun on those things, but it's out there. I will be back very soon with the next installment of your favorite true crime podcast, California Dreaming. And as always, until then, sweet dreams.